I'm delighted to be here tonight to launch the Origin Speaker Series in the cozy confines of Artifact Coffee. This gathering is intended to elevate the conversation about food, its origins, and what is happening around our food system in the Chesapeake Bay watershed. We started our first restaurant, Woodbury Kitchen, with a commitment to local sourcing and now work closely with more than 60 different farmers and growers throughout the region. We supply our four restaurants and our canning and butchery operations with meat, eggs, grains, fish, shellfish, cooking oil, cheeses, and produce, literally everything we need to feed our guests. The hope is that this series will shine a light on the work that farmers and producers are doing in our area. The conversation is being held monthly at Artifact, our coffee shop in the heart of the Woodbury neighborhood in Baltimore.
Tonight's program is about the very important topic of pollinators and honeybees and their crucial role in our food production. We are pleased to welcome a distinguished panel featuring Dr. Dennis Van Engelsdorp, assistant professor at the University of Maryland's Department of Entomology, and an internationally known honeybee epidemiologist. David C. Heisler, farmer and owner of the Comus Market in Comus, Maryland, and Jack Leonard, a landscape architect, beekeeper, and assistant professor at Morgan State University's Landscape Architecture Program. Now I'd like to turn the program over to Dana Slater, the producer of the Origin Speaker Series.
So tonight we have a great lineup of really experts in bees, pollinators, this whole world of landscape architect, what we do in our backyards, what we're doing to the native plant world, how we sort of look at what we're doing with our food sources, and so forth and so on. So to start with Jack Leonard right here is the landscape architect. He's got a master's degree in landscape architecture and he's completing a program in environmental studies. He's also an assistant professor of landscape architecture at Morgan State University School of Architecture and Planning with a focus on urban sustainability. Jack is also a master gardener and a beekeeper. Dr. Dennis Van Engelsdorp is an assistant professor at the University of Maryland's Department of Entomology and an internationally known honeybee epidemiologist. He told me to just say he's the honeybee guy. So his bio goes on for about three pages here. But I'm going to say that. He's the honeybee guy. In the middle, we have our farmer, our expert on biodiversity, David Heisler, was born in the shadow of Sugarloaf Mountain. Comus Market is in Comus, Maryland, a beautiful part of northern Montgomery County that I had never been to and had a lucky day, spent a great day with David, loved seeing his operation. Grew up on a dairy farm, and I'm just going to read a quote of David's, which kind of sums up, I think, his personality. He feels very connected to the land in this beautiful, beautiful corner of Maryland, living such a close proximity to one of the fastest growing suburban regions in the U.S. One of his main goals is biodiversity and landscape conservation. With this in mind, I plant my crops and choose my farming methods to favor biodiversity. Raising honeybees is one part of that. And I'll tell you, one thing David said to me when I met him was he said, I'm not a beekeeper, I'm a bee haver, which I loved. As a sole grower on David's farm, David's priority is producing extremely high quality pumpkins and squashes, which we'll be eating tonight. Depending on the season, Comus Market offers cider, apples, honey, jellies, pickles, preserves, and especially pumpkins and squash. So, without further ado, I'm going to turn it over to Spike.
Well, it's great to see everybody here. I think this is our best turnout yet, and for good reason. This topic is near and dear to a lot of us that care about food. As Dana said, it connects to food in ways that we probably don't all think about every day, but I know we're going to learn a lot tonight about how it does. For me at Woodbury, I think our realization of the role of bees goes back to the very first, to our first beginnings, and probably played into the fact that we put as an epigram on our menu a Joe Strummer quote. I'm also a huge Clash fan, but that was a line from his song Johnny Appleseed, which was, "If you're after getting the honey, then you don't go killing all the bees." And it seemed to condense what Woodbury was going to be all about, and it still does. I think it's still on there after these almost 8 years. And it just was a great starting point for us to think about the food and that we were going to get from this food system and our role in it. The other thing I will say, and why I'm so interested to talk to this panel tonight, is that Woodbury is, and Woodbury especially, is moving away from using refined cane sugars and corn sweeteners in our cooking. And we've made a commitment to be off of refined sugars by 2016, which is looming. And we've been successful in making rather large shifts away from certain commodities. In addition to our intense local sourcing of almost everything else, we've had success moving away from citrus and moving away from non-locally grown and milled flours. And I think the toughest but biggest one that we've made right now is that we are going to have no refined sugars in the restaurant by next year. And so that means a heightened dependence, a heightened reliance, and more use of maple syrup, honey, and sorghum syrup, three things that which we can obtain from local sources. So as a chef and as a restaurant owner who's made these commitments, this is a very great interest. We tend to leap a little bit before we look in these things, but we think that it's the right direction for us and will compel us, as these other choices have, to look a little deeper within our food system. So that being said, I want to welcome our panelists and thank you for being here and taking the time to participate in this conversation. My first question to Dennis, and if you could, even in some of the conversations I had with some of our guests tonight, you know, I heard some of the frustration of keeping bees and how the colonies will die and perish, and how that is, and that's something that I think a lot of us are aware of when it comes to the state of the honeybee in this country and probably globally. Is the colony collapse disorder is an issue, and there I've heard from time to time that it's kind of been solved, but then heard that it's still a problem. And I'd love to get your sense of kind of where we are as the bee guy, as the honeybee guy, with that, and then maybe a broader kind of sense of how this connects into a much larger world of pollinators that we may not be thinking about as much.
Okay, great. Thank you for having me. This is a really an exciting thing to be part of, so I'm very happy for the invitation, and thanks for coming out. I just want to get a sense, how many beekeepers are in the room? So three. How many people in the room have never opened a beehive? So the first thing I will say is that I challenge you to find someone who is a beekeeper and open a beehive, because it's one of those life-changing experiences. Because what happens is you open that hive and you've got 40,000 sisters working in collaboration, and you know the birds are singing, they're making this liquid gold. You have to be in the zen of beekeeping, because if you're agitated, they let you know, and so you have to find that zen. And so it's one of the most miraculous things you can do. And I think right away when you open a hive, you know if you're a beekeeper. They say that. It's in your blood. You stung once, it's in your blood, and you know you're a beekeeper for life. And so I would encourage you to do that. And so it's with that in light that most of us who are beekeepers really have a passion for these amazing creatures. That in 2006, 2007, I was the state apiarist of Pennsylvania, and I got a call from Dave Hackenberg, who's the largest beekeeper in Pennsylvania, and he'd been talking about how his bees were boiling over that October. They were the best bees he'd ever had. And he moved them all down into Florida, as he does every year, and he came back a month later to find that 2,000 of his 3,000 colonies had completely disappeared. If you're ever in a bee yard, you know it has a hum. It has this buzz. And so he talks about getting out of the car or the truck and realizing something was wrong, that it was dead silent, which never happens in a bee yard. And he got on his hands and knees, and he looked into the colonies, and there was nothing there. And this was really new. So he called me up in Pennsylvania, and he trucked some bees up, and soon we found out this was happening in many places in California and Florida, the wintering grounds and most of the colonies in the country. And that's when we termed the term CCD. Colony collapse disorder. And that was because we didn't know what was going on, we couldn't identify a cause, and it died with very specific symptoms. Now, since then, people have used this term, colony collapse disorder, to describe any dead bee colony, which was not our original intent, but we can't fight that anymore. In a nutshell, we have not seen colony collapse disorder by that case definition for 3 years. We've seen a lot of bees die, though, since then. for the last 10 years. Nearly 50% last year of the colonies in the country died. And the, having said that, though, the total number of colonies in the country has remained stable or increased. And that's because beekeepers are really good at replacing dead colonies. So if you have a live colony and a dead colony, you can split that live colony in half, buy a queen, and put her in there, and you've replaced your losses. So we've actually increased the number of colonies managed nationally because they're able to replace them so quickly. So what happened? Well, with CCD, what we think has happened is that the bees, for some reason, became very susceptible to every virus going. And those viruses, when they're in the colony, they induce something we call altruistic suicide. So they're a social organism. There's a big argument that we should not think of a bee as a bee. There's a Latin saying, una apis, non apis. A bee is not a bee. It's the colony. It's the super organism. That's the living entity. And so as a social organism, they've evolved the response that if they somehow know they're sick, they want to fly away from the colony and die away from the colony, not to kill their nestmates. We see this in termites. If termites get a fungal infection, they'll walk out of the colony and they'll tap their foot in a certain pattern that says, it's called the leper's walk. And it's saying, don't touch me because I'm sick. Just let me get out of here and I'll die away. And so we think that CCD, that mass evacuation of bees from the colony and dying away from the hive, was caused by high virus levels. What we don't understand is why they were so susceptible. Now, since then, it's been really clear that bees are dying for a whole bunch of other reasons. And there's general consensus that there are three principal causes. The first is varroa mite. This is a large parasitic mite. If we were a bee, it'd be like a dinner plate feeding on us. And this mite comes from the Asian bee and jumped hosts and eventually made it over here in the 1980s. And there is no question that this mite is killing most of the colonies in the country. 60 to 70% of beekeepers, especially small-scale beekeepers, do not treat for this mite. And what we have evidence for now is that those beekeepers are really trying to do it out of the goodness of their heart. They're thinking, well, if I have 10 colonies, I'll let them survive, and the ones that survive is great, I'll breed from them. So if 9 die, that's okay, I'll breed from the other. But what they forget is that as those colonies die, those bees in the last stages fly away and bring those mites to their neighbors and to their other colonies. And so at the landscape level, we're seeing these huge, especially at this time of year, these huge movement of mites from colony to colony, from neighbor to neighbor. So it's sort of like this tidal wave going right through the state or right through the country. And so that's a major driver. The next one, and we hear a lot about this, of course, are pesticides. Neonics get particularly focused on. We have no field realistic data to show that neonics is a major driver of losses. We have a lot of data that there's a lot of different chemicals coming into the colony, especially fungicides, and we think that they acting together are causing a lot of the damage. We also know that beekeepers have to apply a lot of pesticides to control varroa mite, and they too are part of that problem. And the third, and I think that's where it ties in nicely with the next two speakers, is poor nutrition. We've seen a huge change at the U.S. landscape level in terms of what good bee forage is. And we've seen this over the last 100 years. 100 years ago, all the beekeepers would have been in New York State. It was a cattle state, grew a lot of clover. All the commercial beekeepers were in New York State. When that got replaced with alfalfa, everyone moved to Kansas. It was the best beekeeping state in the country until 1970, and a cow farmer figured out that if you cut the alfalfa at 10% bloom, it was better for the cows. So all the farmers started cutting at 10% bloom. Everyone moved out of Kansas, and they all went to North Dakota. And in North Dakota, over the last 5 years, because of the price of corn and soybean, a lot of land that used to be on CRP, so the government used to pay for them to not use that land for agricultural purposes and keep it in meadow, has been plowed under for corn and soybean in order to go after farm insurance money. And so that means that there's no places left in the United States to bring bees and get them healthy. And so one of the big emphases is we need to make sure that we keep our landscape with pollinator-friendly plants in order to sustain the health. Just like us, if you're malnourished, you're going to not be able to fight off infection or pesticide poisoning. And so the idea is to get as much nutrition into those colonies to keep them
healthy for as long as possible. So I think I've summed that up. Now I do want to say, in terms of the native pollinators, honeybees are not native. They came over with the colonists. They were called the white man fly by the Native Americans because they followed the white man as they walked across the continent. And we have over 5,000 native bees in this country, over 400 in Maryland. And these are jewels. Like, these are beautiful green, metallic blue. And a lot of what we can do is not just about the honeybee, but about these native pollinators, which after all are much better at pollinating native plants than they are, than honeybees are. So I think that helping honeybees also helps, very importantly, this idea of biodiversity.
So Jack, thank you. That was amazing, Dennis. It occurs to me that as you know, we hear about bees and their kind of ubiquity, and not only honeybees, but obviously these native pollinators, that we can think of almost everywhere, whether it's countryside, suburban, or urban areas, as bee habitat, right? And that means that virtually all of our activity somehow is interacting or is having an impact on bees. And I'd love for you to talk a little bit about that.
Well, since you started your conversation with a quote from a song, I'll do the same thing. If everybody remembers Joni Mitchell, they paved paradise to put up a parking lot. That's part of the issue. The way we have developed, the way we have changed the landscape has drastically affected the habitat and the source of food for our native as well as the honeybees. Okay. What we've done, and you can look outside here, is most of the urban landscape is devoid of much plant material, and most of that plant material that is there is not native plant material. Part of the issue we run into, and I mentioned this earlier, is this idea that the native plants are treated as not as valuable as the non-natives. Why? Because the non-native plants don't get chewed on. They stay pretty. They're not as susceptible to our natural viruses and things that are here. So we want to put them in the landscape, and the people that sell us those plants can sell us something that won't be brought back as a problem. A lot of my clients want gardens, and of course the favorite garden is what? A butterfly garden. But nobody wants anything chewing on their plants. So they don't want caterpillars, but they want butterflies. So there's this disconnect in our thought process of how the ecology works. And so what we've done is we've basically replaced our native plants with these non-native plants. One of my favorite authors and a fellow entomologist is Dr. Doug Tallamy out of University of Delaware. He wrote a book called Bringing Nature Home. And it really sunk in with me as a landscape architect that there's such a connection between insect species and certain plants. We assume that if there's a plant out there blooming, that's going to take care of it. But he was saying that specialization is more the norm than the exception, that there's more of these insects and more pollinators are directly related to certain plants than the ability to just be generalist. And so what we've done is we've removed a lot of those plants from the landscape. What I've tried to do is bring those plants back into the landscape, which is sort of easy to do on kind of that suburban rural fringe where everybody has lots of property. Well, how do we do it in the city? We don't think of the city as having a need for pollinators. Because we don't have farms in the city, so why do we care? Well, every plant that has a flower is usually pollinated, your home gardens. And I think, and you correct me if I'm wrong, but the pollinators don't necessarily live in the crop fields in all cases. They are traveling from one place to the other. So by providing habitat in one area, you're actually providing a source of those pollinators for other people that need them. And it also creates the diversity. And we'll hear a little bit more about the farming practices and good farming practices, I guess, as well as bad farming practices. So how do we do that in the landscape? Well, I think the first thing we need to do is start demanding that our landscapes, our landscapers, our sources of plants provide us with more native plants. I do a lot of projects with stormwater issues. We do a lot of rain guards and such, and people are always wondering, where can I buy native plants? Well, the problem is most of the native plant sources are wholesalers. They are not retailers. And so you go to the typical box store or whatever, and you get mainly the plants that always look pretty, the non-native plants, and you'll see a few native plants. Of course, we don't sell the native plants because they have names like weeds, you know, milkweed, sneezeweed, and whatever. And I was mentioning that the thing that's grow up in the middle of the sidewalk is the tree of heaven. And this is one of Dr. Talamy's comments. So I think what we need to start looking at is how do we change our landscapes. And I think part of it is just focusing on the types of plants and then the diversity of plants. You see very sterile landscapes, a lot of all the same plant. There's a lot of spaces to put plants, even in the urban areas, the street trees. Well, there's certain trees such as the oaks, the maples, the willows, the black cherries. And the black cherries are one of the primary sources of caterpillars for nesting birds. Well, the black cherry is the tree that always has that ugly-looking, you know, caterpillar nest that everybody wants to rip down and spray. So we've got to change our attitudes towards what a good and healthy landscape is. So I think, from my perspective as a designer, and also as a teacher of future designers, is to try to get this mindset that let's look at the landscape differently. We want a good, diverse, balanced, all the way from the small, you know, urban lot all the way up to the farm areas.
So, well, that brings up David, and, you know, you're a farmer that I met a couple of years ago. Steve introduced us, I think, and you were growing beautiful pumpkin and squash, but when we first met, all you wanted to talk about was bees and native pollinators. And it drew me in because you were thinking about things in a way that I hadn't heard with all the farmers that I've talked to and all the growers we were working with. You were the first guy that came out and really said, this is part of what I'm doing. This isn't incidental to what I'm doing, and I was just fascinated by your account of, you know, what was going on at your farm and how your crops, the squash that you were growing, and a lot of other things that you chose to grow, mostly because they would support pollinator populations. Is that right?
It's certainly, the pollinators are a huge aspect of my farming philosophy, but my philosophy is biocentric in nature. So I'm trying to, as a farmer who's dealing with the landscape, trying to produce a food source, whether it's for an animal or whether it's for humans, there's competition across that landscape. Some of it good, some of it bad. I grew up on some of the same land that I still walk, so it's been interesting watching the changes of that landscape over half a century. A lot of what I see is a huge difference in the scale that the landscape's being manipulated, the timing of those manipulations. It's not just whether it's a pesticide or insecticide or herbicide, fungicide. A lot of those products have increased, but it's because of the scale of the farming practices now. Even the capacity of how quick yards are mowed. It'd be great to have white Dutch clover in everybody's yard, but when a mowing crew comes in at daybreak and spends the entire day just mowing yards with white clover that are full of bees, that clover may not be helping the bees. I got off the subject there a little bit, but I think so. What I saw trying to produce a crop was pests of all kind, deer, groundhogs, crows, insects, fungicides. And I was using the University of Maryland Extension commercial vegetable guidelines and losing my crop and putting a lot of inputs into it. I have tinkered with quote organic farming. But I'm not organic, and I just say that I'm not conventional. I want to have the potential for any tool in my toolbox. I want to have an understanding of the why, when, and how I use that tool. Once I keep pollinators in mind, it certainly limits the use, the timing of a use. But then I've also changed my planting patterns so that always have ground set aside for pollinators or beneficial insects. I focus on the timing of the pests, timing of pollinators, the timing of my crop, when it needs pollinators, when it doesn't need pollinators, and I try to break up the cycles to interfere with the pests, or have something, plant a crop that's a better draw for a pest to get them away from my crop. I've been able to, in my pumpkins and winter squash, I grow over 40 varieties. I've been able to eliminate my insecticide use completely. Even organic growers can't say that. I've been able to reduce my fungicide applications by at least 50%, some years by 70%, from when I was growing conventionally. I had the benefit as a kid growing up on a dairy farm. We were growing a whole diversity of crops. We were growing all these crops as food sources for our cows to keep them healthy, to produce milk. And that broke the landscape up. So there was wheat, there was corn, there was alfalfa, there was clover, there was barley, pasture fields. In my area of Montgomery County, we had over 400 dairy farms when I was growing up. We have, I think, 5 now. What's taken over, if it's not development, then it's the commodity crop growers. And they get beat up a lot in the press because of their use of pesticides. But I'm rotating my pumpkin fields in an area that is predominantly farmed by these commodity crop guys. And yet I can do it in a way that keeps a sustainable and increasing number of pollinators in and around the farms where I grow my pumpkins. It's not that particular farming practices. It's just not giving the space and the understanding to allow biodiversity to come in. So people always ask me, how many acres do I grow? I don't look at it as acreage. I look at it as a footprint. So it's not just a 20-acre field of pumpkins. It's all the border areas. It's the fence rows. It's the pond. It's the wood edges. All of those areas I can do just minor manipulations with a minimal amount of labor, a minimal amount of cost, and know that it'll support the biodiversity that I want. It's a huge, what I found once I started off managing for pollinators and for pest mammals like deer, over the years I've gotten to see the beneficial predatory insects that come in and use that habitat. I do think there's a symbiotic relationship across the board when it comes to biodiversity. Humans have a tendency to see just the negative. You get bit by an insect and you swell up. It hurts. But is there some benefit that you don't see to your immune system? Certainly, you build up immunity to bee stings.
Well, maybe it turns you into a beekeeper.
Yeah, that's right.
Which would be a benefit. Wow. Well, before we... I think we've got a... I don't know how you guys are feeling. I'm feeling like I've already had my mind blown a little bit. But I guess before we open it up, I would love to look down the road a little bit. Like I said, I'm trying to make this commitment to use only local sources of sweetness for our cooking at Woodbury. Am I crazy to do that? What does it look like going forward with especially with honey from our landscape, as a local product, and what can we do, I think, to ensure that we have sources of honey, in the future?
So, yeah, that's the good question. I mean, we say that there are three things everyone can do to help the bees. One is become a beekeeper, and I've already sort of done that, and so I encourage you to try that. Given that, it's not for everyone. The next one is to buy local honey. Local honey is the most ethical sweetener, as it takes the least amount of carbon to get to your table. And so it's clearly the most ethical in terms of carbon footprint. It's a great resource, and it's also a resource that people both in the rural and the urban area can do. We always joke, we help manage the beehives at the White House. And the first time the commercial beekeepers were going to go visit this White House, they were sort of chuckling because they were saying, look at that, Obama. Because, commercial beekeepers are all really conservative, so they don't really like Obama anyway. But, they were chuckling because here he had 20, like he had 7 or 8 honey supers, and usually a beekeeper has 2 or 3 honey supers. And they say, oh, look, he doesn't know what he's doing. And then they got in there and opened it up, and it was chock full. And that's because often in the city center, there are a lot of lindens and there are a lot of trees that are really good nectar producers, and there are no other bees around. So he did, like he was doing, he's had state dinners serving White House honey. So he did really well. So that's what's great about honey too, is it can come from anywhere. And I think that's exciting. But I think that we've all hit on this point, is that the most important thing we can do is to make sure there is forage there, not just for the honeybees, but also those native bees. And for me, my sort of pivot point was when CCD first broke, I was asked to give a talk in the Champagne region in France, and I had half a day off, and I'm in the Champagne region of France. You know what I wanted to do, right? And the beekeeper of that group insisted that I go and visit World War I cemeteries. And I'm thinking, what? Like, and I'm trying every trick I know to say, I'd rather go to the Champagne caves, Didn't work. And he brought me out, and what you have to know about World War I cemeteries in Europe is that the people who are interned in that cemetery, the government whose people are interned there, control that cemetery. So they manage it by the culturally acceptable practices of that country. So you go to the French cemetery, and it's perfectly flat, perfectly green, and nothing is there. It's dead. And then you go half a kilometer later, and there's the British cemetery, and you have a couple of poppies or whatever growing in front of the tombs, and you have a couple of bees. And then you go to the German cemetery where there's no acceptable use of herbicide. And so even though the lawn is cut, it has dozens of species of flowering plants, and it was alive, and it was immediately across the road from the French cemetery, which makes you think that our idea of this perfectly mown, flat, green lawn is actually just a legacy of our colonial past. It's a disgusting legacy of this sense of privilege, because they're the only people who could afford it. And really, these are green deserts. And so if we change, you remember Give a Hoot, Don't Pollute? Do you remember how you'd never think about throwing things out of your window in your car anymore? And so we need a cultural mind shift to say that it is not acceptable to have these vast expanses of basically parking lots of grass, because there's nothing there. They don't do anything. We need to get away from that cultural mindset and start planning in much more interesting and valuable and culturally important ways. And I think that's the hope, is where we start that movement of making it unacceptable to have large lawns. Make meadows, not lawns, I think is the message.
Yeah, I agree with that. And I think the comment earlier about clover, I remember when I was younger, when you bought grass seed, it had clover seed in it. Clover is a nitrogen fixer, so it's actually good for the lawn. And now what we do is we put this artificial material down with very shallow root systems that really does not much of anything, compacts the soil, so all the ground-dwelling bees really don't have any place to live. We're running over it. We're closing up their sources. So if we can convert more and more of that lawn, plus the lawns are doing what? They're fertilized. They're full of pesticides. They're watered with our potable water sources, which makes no sense at all. And so if we start removing more and more turf, or even mowing it a different way, mow higher, let the clover stay in the grass, change that mindset, but then also start looking at our landscapes in general. I was involved last year, because we're starting to get some emphasis at the federal level. The president had put out for this pollinator initiative, and I was representing as part of American Society of Landscape Architects, kind of the design part of the landscape, and we were putting together recommendations on what we can do starting at the federal level, because the federal government controls an awful lot of land. How do they put policies in place to start promoting healthier habitats, maybe along federal highways, in federal parks, in anything that's owned by the federal government, instead of traditional practices? How can we start putting them in? Some of those were actually started to be implemented. I think a lot of them are more policy than law at this point, but I think we're seeing a shift. I think the idea, even though the honeybees are only a small piece of it, the honeybees is what we see, and the honeybees produce something that we all like, which is honey, so we all get concerned when we start losing honeybees. We're not really sure, I think, how many bumblebees are out there, whether we're losing them at the same rate, whether all these small, you know, bees are being lost at the same rate. They're like the canary in the coal mine, I guess, that they're the indicator that something's going on. But I think the idea of starting to produce better landscapes at all levels and promoting that, you know, whole idea of diversity in the pollinators, because the honeybees only pollinate certain things. They can't pollinate certain things. I think Dennis can probably dig a little bit more into that, and so could David. You know, bumblebees can't get down in little tiny flowers. And actually, if you watch them sometimes, they'll actually be chewing at the base of these deep flowers to open up a hole, because they know the nectar is in there. They just can't get in there from the front, so they'll come in, you know, from the back door. So when we start losing these small species that we don't even know around, you know, the things that we swat, the sweat bees and things, you know, they're very specialized in what they do. They can get down in those little tiny flowers. Well, if the flower disappears or the bee disappears, in essence, they both disappear.
Any thoughts, David, before we open this thing up?
Yes.
I thought so.
Native bees are certainly, for the most part, very specific. And there are. They're all different types and sizes. And basically, what they go to, what they feed on, and what they help reproduce has everything to do with the length of their tongue. Honeybees, and some are specialists. We have a native squash bee that specializes in pollinating pumpkins and squash. And redware, it's one of the few native bees whose populations are on the increase. I have tons in my field. They're rather shy. I've been able to take their photograph from time to time. Native bees are far more efficient pollinators of my crops than my honeybees. And it comes down to their makeup. Honeybees are social, as we all know. They have a huge field force. They have job descriptions that are broken up through the course of their life. So they end their life basically as in the field force. And they die because they wear out their wings, gathering food, water, and nectar, and pollen. But they're also, honeybees are very effective at manipulating the landscape that they roam over. And that's because they are source-specific in their feeding habits. A scout goes out, collects a pollen or a nectar source from a particular type of plant, brings it back, passes it around, tells the other bees in the field force exactly where it is and what it is, and that's what they go to. If it's clover, they can be blooming apple trees all around that clover, and they don't go to the apple trees. So what they do is they concentrate on individual species and are very adept. I think they've evolved to increase the populations of certain species dramatically, so they benefit the following year and the following year. They have the ability to store up food. So if it's cold and wet and damp on an August morning and my pumpkins are blooming and need to be pollinated, they don't have to go out in the rain or the damp or the cool. They can stay in the hive with their all their buds and eat pollen and honey. Have a great breakfast. Native pollinators don't have that ability. So at first light, regardless of the weather, they're out in my pumpkins pollinating. The second thing is pumpkins are most viable first thing in the morning. Pumpkins and squashes are native to the Americas. So they didn't evolve with honeybees. They evolved with native bees. So when I first lost my honeybees to mites back around 1990, that's when I decided that I didn't know what would happen with the honeybees, but I knew we must have native bees that pollinate pumpkins and squash. And my dilemma was trying to think of how can I manage my fields and my overall landscape to keep a population of native pollinators at the levels I need to be able to plant an entire field of pumpkins. Well, I split the difference. I plant my fields, if it's an actual, say, 20-acre field, its proportions are 70-30. 70%, I lay it out. I have a 70-foot swath that pumpkins go in, a 30-foot swath that some secondary plant goes in. It's not a cash crop. It's something that I want to have three positive reasons for planting. Pollinators are a big one, so it needs to bloom. If it produces, say, buckwheat, if it produces a seed that birds feed on through the winter, that's fine with me. That's a positive. If it benefits the soil, that's a positive. If it chokes out some obnoxious annual grasses, that's a positive. Once I started applying that philosophy to different aspects of my through my growing season, I started to see exponential benefits through the course of the growing season. I certainly didn't realize that I would see such an increase in the number of beneficial predatory insects that would allow me to completely cut out insecticide sprays. That was a great surprise. But it also took a bit of tolerance on my part and a bit of risk taking. I had an IPM scout that would come and scout my fields and recommend when I should spray and what I should spray. And IPM scouts do that for producers to limit the amount of pesticides they use and do it only on a timely basis. Well, there were times where when stink bugs first came out several years ago, they were terribly bad. My IPM scout came out and he said, David, you're probably going to have to spray insecticide for the stink bugs. They suck and pierce through the thin skin of the developing pumpkins, deform the growth. Well, I had my fields laid out, 70-30, 70-30, which I found out later where the divine proportions Leonardo da Vinci came up with. But I'm out in my fields every day for hours at a time. During the growing season, I'm walking and observing and taking notes. And that's what I've done for pretty much all my life. Even if I didn't write down the notes, I mentally took notes. Well, there were stink bugs out there, but they were in the buckwheat. I had planted my buckwheat in a timing with my pumpkins so that when my pumpkins were blooming and setting fruit, the buckwheat was going to be more succulent to the deer that wanted to come into the field at night. Minimize the damage to the pumpkins, which minimized disease pressure. I've been able to reduce my sprays. They can come in, migrate through, do what deer do. I was tired of sitting around trying to figure out ways to get rid of them or kill them. And at any rate, the stink bugs were in the buckwheat. It was succulent, and that's where they were. I didn't spray. I didn't take the recommendations of my IPM scout, which wasn't the first time. The last thing I'm going to do, if my pumpkins are blooming, I'm not spraying an insecticide on them. I'll lose my crop before I do that. So as it turned out, I didn't spray. I didn't have a problem with stink bugs in my pumpkins.
Wow. So when I heard this was the topic, sort of like Spike's introduction, any stuff that I had read was like absolute doomsday about the state of bees. So we heard some touching on it. How separate from the notion of creating landscapes that are more friendly to bees, should I be feeling optimistic or pessimistic about sort of the state of where we are for bees in this area and in our country?
The fact is that 5% of the beekeepers in the country own 95% of the 2.6 million colonies. And we are not worried about honeybees going extinct. We're worried about those commercial beekeepers going extinct. And that's because these are the guys who move their colonies. Whether this is sustainable or not is sort of indifferent. They're the last nomadic farmers in the country. And so they start the year in California to pollinate the almonds, which requires over half of the colonies in the country. So everyone who has any sort of numbers of bees moves to California, and they're getting $165-$175 a hive for that 1 month pollination event. But then they start spraying pesticides, so they have to move them out. And so those colonies, so an East Coast operation comes then to Florida, does some melons, goes to New York, does apples, Maine to do blueberries, Massachusetts cranberries, Eastern Shore to do cucumbers or thing. These guys are the ones who cannot afford to lose 50% of their colonies every year and stay in business. So there are a lot of guys there who are making money, but there's an awful lot of them who are just hanging on. And a lot of the work we're doing in our lab is trying to figure out, well, what's the difference between the guys making it and the guys not making it? And so I think that as an industry that relies on a movable pollination force, there is trouble in that agricultural system. We also know that two or three species of bumblebees have gone extinct, probably because of the introduction of bumblebees from Europe to pollinate in greenhouses and a disease they have. And we don't have a good idea of what's happening to these thousands of other native bees. So I don't think we could do this job if we thought there was no hope. Certainly we have to stem this 50% or more loss per year. That's just there's something seriously wrong with that system. Certainly I think that beekeepers in Maryland specifically have to do a better job controlling mites, and a lot of people have been very laissez-faire about that, in a good, nice way, but I think are causing a lot of damage. And so, yes, hopeful, and I think that that there's a movement now, I think that's starting, that a lot of people have been trying to get elevated in the public consciousness that has resulted from it, so that's good. But certainly we need to. There are things that need to be identified and changed. And part of that is certainly how we use the landscape. Part of that is how we use pesticides, whether we use that prophylactically or in response. And I think that's the system you're advocating, is you use it when you need it, not just because you have it. And I think that's part of the solution too. And then just wise, smart action to disease levels.
I'd like to kind of add on to that I also think that there's more positives than negatives, primarily because of what's happening here tonight. There's more awareness and there's more concern, which starts that kind of groundswell. Being a member of Central Maryland Beekeepers, there's more and more new beekeepers every year. A lot of failure, but there's constant, on the email chain every day, questions about bees and you know, issues of how to raise, and maintain their colonies. So I think just the education process, the fact that people are more concerned, they're finally starting to become aware that it's an issue, and most, if you call it a movement, start with that kind of groundswell that says we need to do something about this. And just like any other problem, we can basically attack it from kind of the government level, which is policy and laws, but I think you really change it individually. Every single property, if everybody does a little bit of changing their landscape, a few new people become beekeepers, people do things to promote native bees, I think that's the positive. Now, does that deal with the commercial beekeepers? No, they're not feeding off of my lawn and your lawn. That's a kind of a different animal to deal with. But I think the positive is that we're concerned, and at all levels people are starting to do something about it. We're starting to see the connection. We can't afford to lose these pollinators. Once they're gone, they're gone. I don't think we're going to do a Jurassic Park and find, in our honey, little genetics of bees that we're going to recreate new clones of bees somewhere.
I think you have every reason to be positive, but it's up to the individuals to do something positive. And everybody here can do something positive. It doesn't matter the scale. Just do it. Feel good about it and do it. There's a couple other elements. I think it was briefly touched on. There's an invertebrate conservation group that's promoting roadside pollinator habitat. And at first blush, that sounds great. But with all the problems we have with butterflies and our bees, and especially butterflies, when it comes to roadside habitat, is we have a car is a 2-ton fly swatter going at any speed, okay? And butterflies are just kind of limping across the road at windshield level. My own experience is from driving my backcountry roads. If a butterfly crosses in front of me at any close proximity, if I'm going over 30 miles an hour, that butterfly is probably damaged beyond repair. So I don't recommend that. I mean, it sounds great. There's tons of roadsides. But I think we need to look at habitat in other areas and even corridors. We don't need 2-ton fly swatters swatting up butterflies and bees. I mean, it, certainly it'll be visual, but I doubt any number of monarchs will be able to migrate down 95 and make it to Florida.
If I could bring it way down to a totally local level, if you could give two plants that you would plant in your backyard that would be good native species for birds and bees, if you could give me perimeters, something that the deer like to eat that would keep them on the perimeter as much as possible, and allow whatever's more on the interior to grow up. And if you could tell me how to get my bees through the month of March without dying, I've lost all of them for the last 3 years, every March. So,
you want to start, Jack?
If you could do that, that'd be great.
Well, I don't know if I could pick two plants. There's certain plants that kind of went out of favor that I'm really promoting back again, that are native plants that are kind of midsummer shrubs, things like Itea, Virginia sweet spire is a great plant. Clethra is a good pollinator plant.
And are these trees? Are these bushes?
These are shrubs.
Shrubs.
Trees, of course, the big promotion of trees, if you want the most biodiversity, are oaks. You know, if you can plant oaks. Now, if you have a small property, an oak is probably not the thing you want to plant. Lindens are great. The basswood is the native linden. Is a great pollinator tree that bloom, I guess it's one of the latest bloomers or pollens, nectar sources for bees. And they're not overly large. They're kind of a mid-sized tree. As far as perennials and things, milkweeds are probably one of the best plants because that's also the monarch butterfly host. But, you know, it's also a longer bloomer. Things like if you like butterflies, you've got the Chelone glabra turtle heads, which are the host of the Baltimore checker spot plant. So there's a good source. If you go on, I think it's the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, it's called Native Plants for the Chesapeake Bay Region. It's not in print anymore, but you can get the PDF of it online. And it has all the native plants that would normally have been in the... Now, the Chesapeake region goes from Cooperstown, New York, all the way down into Virginia. But it's basically native plants. And within that, you'll have all kinds of specifications of, does it like wet? Does it like sun? Does it like shade? How big does it get? So it allows you to make that selection. I don't think there's one or two plants, because some of these plants will support multiple species. And in reality, it's your landscape. So it has to be something that you want in your landscape. I don't know if that answered your question, but
I think... That helps, you know.
So how about the dread month of March?
So I'll just add to that, and I think you're right, there's not two plants, but what you want is continuous bloom from spring to fall. And so right now, asters are, so you want asters late fall, goldenrod just passed, so you want goldenrod a little bit earlier. Early spring, you have holly, you have lots of different things. So you want to look at succession planting, because these don't look pretty all year. So you want to just do succession planting so you have something in bloom all year round. I think that's key when you're choosing those. In terms, did you treat for varroa mite and what did you treat with?
You did not.
Well, that's your problem. And that's exactly when they start dying is March, either late summer
or
early
March. So you have to treat.
You have to treat. You have to have a mite management plan in place for responsible beekeeping. Now, there are organic products you can use, organic acids, like formic acid, ants, it's formic A, so formic ants produce formic acid. And actually, sometimes you'll watch a blue jay pick up ants and preen its feathers because it's getting rid of mites using formic acid. And so they also have essential oils. So I'm not advocating hard chemicals necessarily, but you need to have a mite strategy in place. You would not expect your dogs not to get mange if you didn't treat them for ticks and flies or fleas. And so it's exactly the same. It's just not responsible not to treat for mites.
So I thought they starved to death.
No, I'm pretty sure.
No, you think?
This would, and also, I mean, the mites cause, I mean, it disturbs them, so they're eating more. So it could be that, like a lot of people say starvation, but then you should have just fed them more.
Right.
And so that's, if you're losing them consistently and you're not treating for mites, that's the first thing you have to tackle.
Well, What did you see when you opened up the hive, the dead hive?
They were all tucked in. They were totally tucked into each.
In the cells, comb, empty cells.
In the cells, and
was it still capped honey above them?
No, was that totally empty?
They probably starved.
They starved.
Yeah, but I agree.
Why? The other thing is, you need to make sure they have adequate stores. I want to have at least 60 pounds of honey in my hives when they go into the winter. And you get just by picking up, you can get some idea by picking up the back.
Right.
And certainly an empty hive feels empty. The other thing would be, look at, so what was the population of the cluster when they died? A dwindling population because of mites and issues because of the mites. That's the time of year. The other side, what I've seen is that once a population gets to a certain point, and they want, by late winter, they want to fire up a brood chamber. Once they fire up that brood chamber, they have to keep it at 92 degrees, regardless of the weather outside. And they basically kill themselves trying to heat that small area brood. They just overwork themselves. And you can see they'll be wet and slimy from just basically sweating and then freezing.
But can you feed them in the winter?
Dry sugar or sugar candy?
Fondant. Emergency, yeah.
I think the other point you just made is moisture. And I think in a lot of cases you may be sealing up the hive too much. They need that moisture needs to be able to get out. You don't want them to get cold. We have debates all the time. I have screen bottom boards. Leave them on all winter. Leave a little bit of a gap at the top so that the air can get through. They actually did very well this past winter, as cold as it was.
Mm-hmm.
You're trying to keep drafts out, but let air get through. As we say, you talk to three beekeepers, you get 12 answers of what the... Because the bees don't listen to us.
I have a question. We were listening to a talk show a few months ago about bees on the radio, and they said another phenomenon is that for whatever reason, it seems that when a colony loses a queen, it's not making a new queen. And I've had that happen a couple times in the past couple of years, but in midsummer, I just realized that there's no new brood for whatever reason. There's no queen, but it's there's like 50,000 bees in there, and I just can't understand why they're not creating a new queen.
So we conduct this national survey every year, and that's where the loss numbers come from. And the number one cause of mortality, as reported by commercial beekeepers, is queen failure. And so where before we used to have queens that would last easily 2 years, now the average queen is lasting 6 months. And so that's an open question. Now, there are a couple of possible reasons. One is that when a queen first emerges, she mates in her first 2 weeks of life with 16 drones, and she stores all that sperm in a sac, the spermatheca. And if she's had any stress at all or chemical exposure, she's not able to maintain that sperm alive. And so that sperm dies, and so she's laying duds, basically. The other one is that if there are high virus levels, the way that the colony sneezes is to replace the queen. But if there's not sufficient strength in that colony to replace the queen, so we think that that's another driver. So yeah, we've seen really high levels of queen replacement where they're not getting replaced, so queen supersedure. And it's not clear why it is. But again, those three drivers, we think the viruses associated with the mites have come to play. We think that nutrition could come to play, but probably also pesticides may come into there, that the colony is so stressed that somehow that process is not replacing. But it's a hot topic right now.
Right. So one of the things that I read was that some people say, well, you should be requeening your colonies every year.
Absolutely.
And I talked to my bee mentor, and he said, well, I'd never requeen. So I don't know what the right answer is.
Certainly, you are not a commercial beekeeper in business today if you do not replace your queens once, maybe twice a year. So I can say that for commercial beekeepers. I don't think that that's always true for backyard beekeepers. I do think, though, that we know from these survey responses that people who report replacing their queens once a year lose significantly fewer colonies than those who don't. So that's epidemiological based on about 20,000 responses.
What's the best time of year to do that?
Well, I would try to buy local queens if you can, and so then you're sort of dependent on the local market because they don't have early queens. So I would midsummer if you can get them. You can do it in spring. That's easier to find the old queen and replace them, and then you have some too. So it's not a simple answer. It depends on how many colonies you have, what queens you want to introduce.
Dennis, do you find that we're so concerned about swarms that we remove all these queen cells trying to stop swarms, and we're not allowing the hives to reproduce queens on their own because that fear? So we go in and we find all the swarm cells and we start taking all the queen cells out.
So swarming is a natural behavior of bees to reproduce, right? So they produce the old queen leaves with half the colony. Swarming is a genetically defined trait, though. So, but if we were to let them swarm, they would just swarm more because then we're breeding for swarming. So I think you're right. If you find supersedure cells, which look a little bit different, I would leave those in. But I would not encourage us to have more swarms, no. I think, especially in the urban environment, I think that just causes problems.
For me, actually, I'd let my hive swarm just for that reason. I think I grew up where every hollow tree, every abandoned house had a feral hive. I watched them all go by the wayside when the mites hit in the late 80s. So it was clear to me we lost a huge percentage of our genetic within the honeybee population. When I, late 90s, when I was buying queens, I wasn't particularly happy. They were coming from California. They could build up a hive really fast. But to me, those seven box hives are too large. What I would find, one is you're constantly adding boxes, supers, and they're filling them up with the nectar sources, but now you've lost your ability to go in and check and manage the mites. And those populations are increasing. Now all of a sudden, into July, early August, the nectar sources would dry up. And I had this huge population of bees that were just under stress. You can try pulling boxes off, some of the supers off, but then you just have too many bees to fit in the hive that's left. Again, stressful. I invariably would lose those hives. What I found was the hives that swarmed, I had a much better chance of one, if not both, surviving. So no doubt I didn't get the honey that I would have gotten off that seven super hive, but I'm a bee haver. I want to have bees. When the bees wanted to swarm, they swarm when they know it's the best time. They raise healthier queens. The queens are getting, they're larger celled. There's more royal jelly. My take was I was getting better queens from the swarm cells. And I wanted to keep, as you pointed out earlier, I was trying to keep back some genetics that I found that seemed to make it. I can't say there was any rhyme or reason, but the swarming cycle, also what I found, my observation was it was breaking up the mite cycle in two ways. One, the hive that swarmed, if I caught it, I would try to get it on new foundation, so it's building all new cells. And those bees may have some mites, but they don't have a brood chamber for those mites to expand their numbers yet. It takes a while. The existing hive that the queen left with those young bees, since it's generally the height of the nectar flow, very quickly, without a mated queen, for those couple weeks that she mates and hasn't started laying, they very quickly fill every empty cell. All the brood hatches out, and that entire hive is full of nectar. Again, the brood cycle's being broken, and the mite cycle's being broken.
I absolutely agree that. And the other thing we know is that if you split, you can accomplish all those same things without chasing a swarm. So just before swarming, you can split that colony in half and do the same thing. I think the worry about letting colonies just swarm, especially I think that in your area that makes sense. But if you start letting that happen in Baltimore or D.C.,
then we have a problem of swarming, and that just brings the negative connotations. I think it's only responsible for urban beekeepers especially to prevent swarming, to stop some of the hysteria that happens around swarms. So I agree with you completely that, that managing your colonies in such a way that you split and break up the brood pattern reduces varroa, and that's an excellent part of that toolkit. But I don't, and if you're in an isolated area, swarming is great, but I don't know that it's appropriate for every situation.
Mm.
Yeah.
So, a question related to a comment that Jack made about advising on federal policy. And I think everybody in the panel has in some way been affected by policies about food regulation. David, I know Montgomery County debates in the county council about pesticides. And Jack, you mentioned the policy discussions you are. And Dennis, you're probably that famous bee whisperer we heard about at the White House, impacting policy. But there are many competing issues today. For every good thing you talked about, whether it's local sourcing, keeping the beekeepers alive, trying to retain your smallness surrounded by bigness, and trying to plant more pollinators in the urban areas, we hear about the problem of eating more almonds during droughts, as opposed to now, because they require so much water. The fact that big crops really are taking over, and everybody's fear of GMO being used enough. Others mentioned earlier, where do we stand today? But I would ask a question, even though people don't like to get into policy discussions. Are there policy discussions that we actually need to start having? And what should they be?
Well, I'd like to first off say that what Spike's doing is a good start to a lot of this. If you get the local grocers, the local consumer, the local restaurants to start looking for that local source and really forcing that issue, that starts that ball to roll. Plus, it's a good education process. But I think also simple things like the government has invasive species lists. Some of the plants you can still buy at the garden center are on those invasive species lists. Why are we doing that? If this plant is supposed to be so bad that the federal government or state government will put that on a list, and then we can still go to the nursery and buy that, that means we're still out there propagating these plants. So I think just the idea of trying to make policy and common sense work together, I think would be a good thing. But I think even just at the local government level, the landscape manuals that the county uses or the city uses to force the issue of native plants. I know in Baltimore County, if you want to plant anything on county property, it better be an oak or it better be a different kind of oak. Because basically they are promoting, basically trying to we're not going to end up with oak hickory forests, because I don't think we're going to find many viable hickory forests anymore. But basically we're trying to recreate the ecology that may have been here before. So that's a policy type thing. So when I respond on a design that requires permitting from the county, I must follow their landscape manual. So if that manual dictates native plants, because what the developer will do, he'll respond to what he has to do. He wants to get the thing built. He wants to get that property sold. So he's more than willing to plant native plants just to get the project moving. If it allows him to plant something else that's cheaper, that looks prettier for a season, he just soon do that. But he doesn't really care. It's about responding to his needs. So I think those kind of policies are very easy to do, and they don't hurt anybody.
Are there any bad policies, though?
I don't know if it's bad or not, but one of the things that we're looking at trying to constructively change is right now landowners get a credit if they plant 100 trees per acre, and this is for the Chesapeake nitrogen phosphorus thing, and it requires it to be trees. And so one of the things we're trying to advocate for and do some of the background research for is, well, can't that just be meadows? Where you have some grasses that are deep-rooted so that we're still getting the nitrogen, so that we've gone very tree-centric in the world of global warming and all that, but I think we've gone a little bit too far, and we have to recognize that meadows are an important part of the landscape too.
that benefit pollinators and also probably have a lot of these positive benefits too. And so that's something in Maryland locally I think we can do. Also, there are regulations that some cities and townships prevent bees. They consider them dangerous animals. There's been a big movement in New York to change that law, and I think we should try to stamp that out, because anytime you have a law that prevents honeybees, it sort of opens up the opportunity for non-managed, which tend to be more aggressive, to move in. So I think these are some examples of where there's regulation, where it needs to be changed or discarded in order to help bees.
Why the meadows are not, in this part of the country, were not part of the original natural habitat? My understanding is with the Maryland Department of Environment that their goal now is to return as much of the landscape as possible to the way it was pre-colonial era.
Right.
So that's why they don't advocate creation of meadows.
So you don't think there was any meadows in Maryland before the...
Well, it's not...
It was all chestnut? That.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know. It was all chestnut before we came, wasn't it? Yeah. So I don't know. I think that there is. I mean, certainly we have the diversity here to suggest that there were meadow feeding wildlife and bees. So that's the interesting. I've not heard that there was exclusively forest. So it's a good point. I don't know. I'd have to look that up.
I could go into that a little bit. My take of our landscape, certainly my landscape. There were definitely meadows. We may well have been the majority of forested ground, but the Native Americans were active farmers in many of the lowland bottoms for creeks in my area. We find artifacts. Not so much now that we're no-tilling, just about all the ground, but when it was plowed, you could walk out and find artifacts. I have many, even when it goes back as far as being a Clovis Point. We had beavers, and I've watched as the beavers have returned in the past 50 years. They come in and build up a dam along a creek. If it's in a forested area, it opens that area up. It may last several years, may last 10, but it eventually gets abandoned. When that dam rots and breaks away, all that silt is held back, and it immediately grows up into a small meadow. And I suspect that's one of the things the Native Americans would move into then to plant. You'd have certainly nutrient-rich soil. And they're trying to grow corn, pumpkins, and beans.
I would just say I'm not an expert on policy by any stretch, but we hosted Senator Ben Cardin and a few others and a bunch of farmers at Woodbury a couple months ago. And it was refreshing, I think, to hear agriculture in the state of Maryland described and taken at, and I'm talking about the agriculture that we support, taken as, you know, something that had value and merit and should be thought about as worthwhile. Because we all know that I think in this state it's been corn, soy, and chickens for too long. And once those voices were heard from growers of organic produce, but also, you know, we had oyster growers represented, and they were an incredibly articulate voice for what they thought needed to happen in this state. I don't think beekeepers were represented, but I think we need to understand, and, you know, what we're hearing is how all of these things are so interconnected within this food system for sure and beyond. I think the first step is for us to start advocating on behalf of these things and get to the people that can make a difference. Again, I'm no expert on policy, but I saw firsthand, because I know from that meeting, Cardin's gone on and helped our oyster growers, for one, get past some of the roadblocks that were inhibiting their growth in our part of the Chesapeake Bay. First step is being an advocate like these guys clearly can be for these practices.
A real specific pesticide question. I'm in a retail garden center, so I have customers that want to spray for bugs and weeds. And one thing that comes up that I feel like I've gotten completely opposite answers on is imidacloprid, which is a systemic pesticide. And in your opinion, will that travel all the way through a plant to the flower and affect the bees? Do we know, or what? Because I might have one neighbor who wants to get rid of the scale on their holly or get rid of the Japanese beetle grub, so they're going to put it down, and it's going to come into the clover flower or into the holly flower.
So, yeah, this is a really hot topic. And so I think it's important to differentiate some of the risk associated. So the whole idea of these neonics was that you coat the seed, and that way you don't have to spray very much because the plant sucks it up and it gets into the leaves, so anything that chews on the leaves dies. Now, plants naturally have evolved all sorts of toxins to prevent herbivores, and they've also developed filters that prevent that toxins from getting into the nectar and pollen. So in those neonic-treated plants, certainly we're finding evidence of it in pollen and nectar. But it's not the presence that's so important, it's the amount. And so we have not yet found levels that we think can cause harm in nursery stock that was treated then. However, some people will root drench, and this was a big case of that in Oregon, where they root drenched a basswood tree. And as a result, hundreds of thousands of bumblebees were dead in this Target parking lot the next day. And that was to prevent aphids from pooping on people's cars. And so certainly there is a disconnect between using these highly toxic and highly problematic things that are easy to misuse for when there's no human risk or food safety risk involved. Like, why are we using this to control aphids from pooing on people's cars? Just park somewhere else. So that seems a disconnect. At the same time, though, I think that the neonics, in some cases, I think it's overused. Like right now, you can't buy corn that isn't treated unless you ordered a year before. So there's a disconnect there that we're using way too much of this. But as a tool in the toolbox, when you have a problem, it's probably a lot better than some of the other pesticides, because the other pesticides would kill. We've had bee kills of 50. One guy lost 50,000 colonies one year from a product that's that neonics replaced. The problem with neonics is it's not killing colonies outright if it's hurting them at all. It's a sublethal effect, and so it's very hard to monitor. I will say, though, that neonics are probably having I don't think that there's any credible evidence to show that neonics having a dramatic effect at the colony level. However, it's probably hurting native bees much more seriously. And that's because a colony of bees can lose 30% of its workforce and still survive. Where if you hit out a queen bumblebee, you've lost that whole generation. Or the solitary bees, you've lost a generation. So I think the neonic story is more harmful for the natives than for the honeybees.
I think the idea of biodiversity helps also, because the more natural predators you have to fight off some of the insects that you're concerned about, you create a balance. And I think we've created an imbalance that the native predators aren't there anymore. And so a lot of, especially the invasive insects, now are able to proliferate, and our native insects can't fight them off. I don't know if it's anecdotal or not, but you were talking about stink bugs earlier, and we had at our place, you just stink bugs everywhere. And then later, like the second summer, I was mowing down in kind of our field, and I noticed mantids, praying mantises, everywhere. All different. So they were just coming up, and I started noticing less stink bugs. Now, whether the mantids decided the stink bugs didn't taste that bad and they started eating them, I don't know, but that diversity of a native predator starting to maybe fight back. But if we'd gone and killed off, you know, all the habitat for the mantids, would they have then not been available to maybe take care of this other pest? So I think just the idea of enough diversity that you have this balance trying to be established, where landscapes that have one or two plants in them, or areas in the city where there's whole areas devoid of plants, and then all you have is one or two species, there is no diversity. And so what you start having is whatever can feed off of that plant becomes the dominant species, and if that's something you don't want, then what do? We come back, we start spraying. We need to get rid of that, you know, that pest.
Last question. Oh, sorry. Let's
take a look at Harvard. Quick one, because GMO is often discussed, but we haven't talked about it tonight. Is there any relevance or impact of GMO farming, pro or con, to the fate of bees and biodiversity?
I won't grow any GMO modified plants, but I can't speak for other farmers as far as the economy of that. What I will say, since I'm surrounded by plenty of commodity crop growers that are using GMO crops, I don't find them per se negative on my ability to keep a healthy population of, and biodiverse population of pollinators and bees and beneficial insects in general. And some of it is simply because a GMO bean field is clean. It's not, or corn, it's not bringing pollinators and other beneficial insects in. It's not habitat for them. But you could certainly improve and promote habitat in and through those GMO fields, I'd say very easily on the scale that I do. That could then in turn be habitat for, again, beneficial insects that would help reduce other pests that come into those GMO crops.
So there's a couple of different GMOs. I mean, directly, we fed GMO pollen to bees, and we have no noticeable effect on bees, and that makes sense. The GMO that's supposed to help against corn borer is a Lepidoptera, so the caterpillars and moths and butterflies, and it's a protein that breaks down their gut, and so then what happens is the natural bacteria in the caterpillar's gut gets into the bloodstream, and they die from blood poisoning. And we have autopsied tens of thousands of bees, and we have never seen symptom of septicemia, and all the evidence shows that there's no direct relationship. Now, is there indirect? Because we have Roundup Ready stuff, and that's killing all the weeds much more easily, and that might be reducing forage. So there may be indirect effects, but certainly there is no evidence of direct from direct feeding of the pollen.
Differ with that notion. I mean, I agree with the no direct effect on bees, but the indirect effect is huge. I mean, and I think that's the theme of what we've been talking about. Monoculture, more than anything, has wiped out the diversity of our habitat, which has killed the insect populations. And I had this conversation with the head of Chesapeake Heritage Wildlife Foundation, Ben Garber, who said that the quail had disappeared because our biodiversity has disappeared, and I think it's directly attributable to GMO growing. You may be onto a solution in growing other crops with other species of plants within GMO fields, and maybe that's a policy we need. But I think the two are very much linked. And I may not understand it well enough, but that's my impression that GMO growing is very much linked to the loss of species diversity in our and which is a directly killing our insect population.
I'd like to go over this. That the decline of the quail in Maryland in my area was far earlier than any GMO crops. It actually coincided with the switchover to no-till farming, which most people agree was a huge benefit for the environment. And the reason being, with any farming practice or any sort of landscape management, if you want to support bees, it's not willy-nilly. You have to think it through. And if for any biodiversity, otherwise you'll create what I refer to it as a sink, where you're inviting this biodiversity in, and then because you, for some reason, decide to do a different manipulation, you've just taken everything that they've come in to enjoy and reproduce on. You've taken away. Now, in the case of the quail. Growing up on a dairy farm with all these diverse crops and fields, one of the things we did for our corn, in order to plant corn in our area, we had to plow that field the fall before. From a soil standpoint, that was terrible. It went through the winter bare. but that was the only way you were going to be able to come back in the spring. It was going to dry out quick enough that you could work that field down and get your corn planted in a timely fashion before the weeds absolutely took over. So basically you had an area, if you were planting corn, you didn't have quail trying to nest in that field. The quail were going into the fields that had cover. But now we switch over to no-till farming, and every field now has a cover crop. You're going in to covered fields that are prime nesting habitat for quail, and now doing your manipulations to plant your corn. I've heard some people say, oh, it was the chemicals. I disagree, it was the chemicals. It's just the total switch over of the habitat. It was in this great habitat of growing plants. It had protection from birds of prey because of the cover. There were plenty of insects, but now you're using a herbicide to burn off that cover. And not just that, you're coming back with a tractor that's set with a planter that's splitting that sod every 30 inches. The chances of a nesting bird in that field making it through is not very good. I'm convinced that's the demise of our quail. And remember, we no longer have meadowlarks. When I was a kid, in the evening there'd be a meadowlark in every single fence post singing away. They're gone. A number of our field birds are gone. It has nothing to do with GMO crops. It's the way we're managing. It's the way we're growing. And that gets back to scale. Everything, it's about scale.
Plant meadows.
Maybe we can end on that. And I will talk about the menu. You know, the first thing I'd like to say is I wish everybody could hear this conversation and what these guys had to say tonight. But they can, because we are on Heritage Radio Network, and this will be up soon. And I'm going to go back and listen to it, because I can't thank you guys enough for this. And that said, we do have a great little meal plan for everybody. There's honey all the way through it. It won't be that sweet, but we have the centerpiece is a beautiful ham sandwich that we made with parts and labor ham, some Hawkshill cheddar, lettuce from, gosh, I should know this. Bread that we baked over at Woodbury Kitchen, honey mustard made with the honey that you brought.
Well, Karen brought.
Karen brought. And our mustard from our good friend Heinz Tome. We also have a spoon bread made with local corn and a little more honey and some squash. We have a couple salads and some honey glazed carrots, and all topped off with some honey pie.
Honey pie.
Wow.
You guys will all enjoy that. We'll continue the conversation over supper. And once again, thank you all for being here. Thank you, Dave.
Thanks again for joining us tonight at Artifacts for our Origin Speaker Series. And thanks to Dana Slater for producing the program, Hannah Reagan for her masterful coordination, and particular thanks to the Broadcasting Institute of Maryland for recording this evening's conversation. We're grateful to be partnering with Heritage Radio in Brooklyn, New York for creating a home for the Origin Speaker Series.